First order of business is okay. 3252, and Patrick's on the phone, but as soon as he gets back, he's going to put us over.
Nonchalantly jumping over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3252, establishing speed limits for rural interstate highways. Attached in your packet, you'll find a fiscal analysis for that bill, which we just received today, and also some testimony on the bill from Gail Ackerman, who's one of the Transport and Transportation Commission.
Very good. Thank you very much, Patrick. Let's see. Jim Anderson and John... Is it Tom?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Welcome. Mr. Chairman Gilman, members of the committee, my name for the record is John Tung. I'm an orthopedic surgeon practicing in Tualatin, Oregon, and I'm also representing today the Oregon Association of Orthopedics. I'm an orthopedic surgeon. And the Speed Zone Review Panel, I'm passing out a copy of the result of our 10 public hearings this past year of the Speed Zone Review Panel, in which the five members unanimously voted against raising rural interstate highway speeds. And it's well written. I hope that you'll have a chance to review that. The second handout is my comment on the eight reasons that I've heard in the last 7 years that I've been studying the speed issue that people propose on why we should raise highway speeds. The first, if I may briefly run through these, Mr. Chairman, is the argument that it will increase respect for the law and that we're actually developing contempt for the law by not raising speeds because so many people are driving above the posted speed limits. In the state of Washington in March of 1996, they raised their highway speeds from 65 to 70. They have five times the presence of highway patrol on the state roads or the interstates of Washington that we have, and their speeds when they went from 65 to 70, what they call the 85th percentile speed, rose from 71 to 76. So my response to that is that even in the presence of greater law enforcement, we'll simply produce the same number of lawbreakers in the future driving at higher speeds, and that will not improve respect for the law. Second argument made is that we have safer cars. I heard this on Lars Larson driving down today. Unfortunately, the benefits of safety belts, airbags, and crumple zones rapidly degrade at speeds above 35 miles an hour. So we have smoother, quieter cars that seem much safer, but at high speeds, there's not a great deal of added safety. The third argument is that we have safer roads and that the fatality rates have been dropping for the last 30 years, approximately 3% per year, and this is true. But we've also reduced drunk driving, gotten people in Oregon to buckle up at a 92% level now, and we do have safer cars in crashes, particularly at the lower speeds. But 90% of fatal crashes involve deliberate choices of behaviors, the report from the Speed Zone Review Panel refers to the argument about safer roads as irrelevant. So the rates are down, but we still have 500 deaths per year, and there are 70 injuries per death. The fourth argument is that the economic benefits of increasing speed outweigh the risk. You're all familiar with the idea that the force increases with the square of the velocity, but the fatality rate increases to the fourth power with increases in highway speeds. And I'm giving a reference in that in my handout. The fraction of time that would be saved would be 7% in ideal uninterrupted trips of 25% of the vehicle miles traveled in the state of Oregon. Offsetting that benefit will have, in my opinion, an additional 40 deaths and hundreds of additional severe injuries costing the taxpayers millions of dollars. Currently, speeders in Oregon kill over 200. In 2003, speed killed was associated with 273 deaths in the state of Oregon. Alcohol and all other drug-related crashes, by comparison, there were 208 deaths. The fifth argument is that if we had more enforcement, that this would work. And I pointed out the experience in the state of Washington. The Oregonian article this morning points out that we've had a 30% drop in our enforcement levels in the state of Oregon. And in talking about super speeders, I would simply make the point that they will continue to make the major contribution, if you will, to speed increases after an increase in posted speeds. And I refer you to statements by Leonard Evans in his book, Traffic Safety. The sixth argument is that there's public support for this. ODOT has done a good job every summer for the last decade in surveying the public and their attitudes about this, and a minority of Oregonians are in favor of higher speeds. And I'm sure after reading the headlines in the Oregonian today, that number will be even less. Eastern Oregonians, interestingly, are just as opposed to higher speeds, despite the greater distances they travel, possibly because they experience much higher numbers of deaths per population. During our 10 public hearings of the Speed Zone Review Panel this past year, testimony was evenly split among our citizens. As expected, safety advocates such as the Alliance for Traffic Safety, Community Traffic Safety, and the medical community that Jim and I represent today spoke with strong opposition. No organization in the state of Oregon testified in any of those hearings in favor of raising interstate speeds in the state of Oregon. The seventh argument is that other states have raised their speeds, and we're behind. The reference I give you from Wellington shows that the states that raised their speed limits from 65 to 70, as you would expect from the exponential increase in fatality rates that I projected, increased 35% here in the United States. And I went and looked, you know, we'd like to compete with the state of Washington. So I looked at the 2 years before and after this, the change in March of 96 in the state of Washington. If you add the 2 years back to back, which is, I think, a little more fair than cherry picking individual years, Oregon's deaths the 2 years before compared to the 2 years after the change in Washington decreased by 18. The deaths in the state of Washington are in that same comparison increased by 93. Another little-known fact is that there's something called the crossover effect. When people drive off the interstate, they become velocitized or speed-adapted, and they drive down a road that is more open and four times more dangerous per mile to drive on. And the increase in the deaths in the state of Oregon in 1987, which I researched, showed that the unintended consequence of that phenomenon increased the deaths by doubling the increase in deaths on the interstate to the adjacent roadways. And I have that data to show you if you're interested. So there was an increase immediately in the speeds of only 3.5% on the interstate when we went from 55 to 65 in 1987. But the increase in the adjacent roadways where the signage didn't change at all was 7.0 miles per hour increase, and a resultant increase in deaths. And finally, the personal freedom argument, which I have been dealing with since I filed the Oregon Safety Belt Initiative in 1990. Freedom should not endanger others. Speeders kill more Oregonians today than drunk drivers, as I just pointed out in the earlier comment. 40% of deaths caused by excessive speed are innocent people, disproportionately striking women, children, and seniors in our state. So I urge you to vote no on House Bill 3252. And I'd like to call on Jim Anderson, who represents the emergency room physicians.
Mr. Chair, Jim Anderson with the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians here today with Dr. Tung in opposition to House Bill 3252. We realize you will receive several arguments today in opposition to this bill, and we would like to submit some additional information above and beyond what Dr. Tung has just submitted, and I may also find it necessary to repeat some of the items he has brought to your attention. The increased speed on our nation's highways is a factor of 30% of all fatal accidents, killing an average of 1,000 people each month. The economic cost to society from speed-related accident totals over $28 billion each year. These are statistics from the NHTSA. And the health costs alone are over $2 billion a year. National statistics also show 37% of all drivers ages 14 through 19 involved in fatal accidents were speed-related. In 1974, the National Research Council attributed 44,000 fewer fatalities to the national 55 miles per hour speed limit. People often opt to travel somewhat faster than the posted limit by choosing a speed they perceive as unlikely to result in a speeding ticket. In 2003, April 20th, the Oregonian got it right, even though this may seem at this time somewhat dated. The question is, why should we tinker with something that's actually working in the state of Oregon? Fatalities right now are at record lows. Why put manpower into studying a change that transportation safety experts believe will increase fatalities along with serious injury accidents? It's true that people disregard the speed limit, but if it were raised, they would disregard the new limit too. The article goes on to say that speed cancels out the safety effects of speed belts and airbags and exponentially increases the impact of crashes, something Dr. Tung just went over. Unfortunately, when Congress lifted the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit requirement in 1995, it also eliminated the state-by-state data gathering. It made it easy to analyze the effects of speed limits, so a definitive analysis is hard to come by. Why raise speed limits in Oregon? That's cut back dramatically on one of the most effective curbs on speeding, state troopers. Today we have, and this again was 2003, and I don't think the numbers have increased greatly, but today we have 329 troopers policing 7,500 miles of roadway, a cutback of 460 troopers from 2001 numbers and 665 in 1979. It makes no sense to raise speed limits and lower enforcement. Dr. Tung mentioned today's article in the Oregonian. Some of you may have seen it, some of you may not have. It stated in there, and I thought it was rather interesting, that citations for 90 miles per hour plus have increased by 4% over the last year. Now, we all know that whether this bill passes or fails, we're still going to have people doing those types of speeds on Oregon interstate, rural interstate highways. I just wonder what kind of message in passing this bill this sends to those people when you say, okay, 65 should be increased to 70. What kind of message does that give to the speeder who potentially is going to go out there anyway? We were all young once. We all got our driver's licenses at 15 or 16 or 17, depending on where you live. And we all felt rather bulletproof at the time. I know I did. And there's a lot of people out there, a lot of youngsters, ages 14, 19, in their early 20s, who feel the same way. They need to get from point A to point B as quickly as possible. When if you increase the speed from 65 to 70 between Salem and Portland, you leave the city limits of Salem and arrive the city limits of Portland 6 minutes quicker. Now, is that worth the potential danger you put to yourself and the other drivers on the road? We think not. Handed out to you also, you'll notice there is a document, the presentation to the Oregon Transportation Commission. This is a document that was prepared by a Mr. Brant Williams. He's the chair of the Oregon Speed Zone Review Panel. I am submitting this to you because it is a public document, and Mr. Williams did not solicit me to present this to you. I am doing this on my own. But I felt it was interesting and important information for you to look through. I would just like to point out a couple areas in this document that caught my eye. And the first one was on page one, and it's about two-thirds of the way down, the numbers 1, 2, and 3. To raise the maximum speed limit for cars on rural interstate highways, these are the arguments based on the draft recommendation. The panel firmly believes that the 65-mile-an-hour maximum speed limit is safe and reasonable speed for our rural interstate system. The evidence is fairly conclusive that any increase in speed limits will result in an increase in speeds, which in turn will result in more crashes, injuries, and fatalities in the interstate system. On the second page, there are three bullets. These three bullets, again, I'm not going to go over them. I had planned on it. Dr. Tung has already gone over them, the reasons why people feel that an increase in speed is justified. Thirdly, on page five, there are nine bullet points on page five. This indicates to you that the Speed Zone Review Panel is indeed continuing their work, and it's an ongoing mission that these people have. This is the criteria they're following. These are the questions that they're trying to answer on a month-to-month, year-to-year basis. With all due respect to you, Mr. Chair, and others of the committee, I believe the timing could not be worse for the introduction and passage of this bill. Our fuel costs are at an all-time high, and supplies could be and most likely are dwindling. It is the responsibility of the legislature to set an example for their constituents by adopting good public policy. In my opinion, it is not in the best interest of good public policy to pass legislation that would endanger lives and property, lead to higher fuel costs, and waste petroleum products through higher speeds on interstate highways. Again, we at the Emergency Room Physicians, OSEP, strongly oppose this bill, and I know Dr. Tung and I both open ourselves to the committee for questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jim. Question. Representative Pat.
You looked right at me. You knew I'd have a question, didn't you, Chair Gilmore? I do have a question on who makes up the Oregon Speed Zone Review Panel. How many people are on that? Where do they come from?
There are five of us. It's listed on the back of the report that I gave you, with a little bio about each of us. We have three engineers, a state patrol officer, and myself.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's exactly the same direction I was going. Based on your experience, Dr. Tung, on that panel, any recommendations looking forward of additional voices that should be on that panel or additional parts of the process, or did you feel like it was pretty all-inclusive?
I thought it was quintessential Oregon democracy at work. I was thrilled with the process. I really was. And that's a process that they did not have in the state of Washington, where they raised their speeds. Three people met in a room, made a decision. We went out to the public. We heard from the public. We studied the issue. We debated the issue, and I'm very proud of this report.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like either one of you to just comment on the fact that August 13, 2004, the Oregon Department of Transportation published the Interstate Highway Speed Limit Engineering Investigation. And in the executive summary on that, it says that the investigation indicates that in most areas where the speed is currently set at 65 miles per hour for cars and 55 for trucks, the posted speed limits on Oregon's rural interstate highways could be set at 70 for cars and 60 for trucks, which is what this bill is proposing to do.
That report was written by Ed Fisher, and our report, which Jim Anderson handed you, specifically explains that the Speed Zone Review Panel disagrees with that statement.
Further questions?
Thank you for bringing that up.
You want to follow up?
Yeah, if I may. Sure. Thank you, sure. Mr. Chairman. So, so we have engineers that are saying that from their perspective, and I'm presuming that this means that as far as the design of the highways and the construction, et cetera, that from an engineering perspective, they're okay with it, but we have a review panel that, for reasons, don't agree, and those reasons are because...
I think the review panel looks more at the behavioral characteristics rather than the roadway. And the engineers look at getting people and products from A to B as quickly as possible, and they're much more focused on the roadway. I think there's a culture difference there.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Boone.
Well, I have a couple of things I wanted to say, and I agree with Jim's testimony. One of the things that people don't think of when they think of speeding, and I can't remember which one of you said that you get there 6 minutes sooner. Invariably, you'll have somebody behind you following too close, going too fast, which takes even longer to stop. If something happens, and this is in talking about rural roads, I live on one, a deer jumps out, a dog jumps out, a car pulls out, and you've got two lanes of traffic, there's nowhere to go. And you can't stop in time, even if you stop true and straight. There's just the law of physics takes so long to stop. Add to that the mix of young and inexperienced drivers. They may be great drivers. They may have passed their tests and all that, but they don't have the experience of having those near misses. Add rain, snow tires, ice, other weather elements, sun blinding you. All these things play into this mix. And then the doctor, I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Just like tongue in your mouth.
Tongue, okay. not putting you on the spot or anything, but you know what happens to why people die when they hit, even at 55 miles an hour. It's a 110 mile an hour hit. Your heart, you just jerk and your heart comes off, it comes out of place. And isn't that what kills a lot of people? Because the people we find in the cars after a wreck often are fully intact. The car is a mess. And if there's nothing that's gone through the person or anything like that, which is what causes the messy person part, but sometimes they're just dead. We have found one guy lighting a cigarette, and this is how he ended up. And he was in perfect shape, but he was quite dead.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the third collision. The car stops, mm-hmm. the body stops, and then the organs inside the body move forward, your brain, your heart. And that's exactly right. The average age of death on the roadway in Oregon is 27. The highest risk age is 18.
And a follow-up just to that. One thing, and I guess would be a good argument for high speeds, would be you wouldn't have the person who's left still alive after something like that, which is a huge cost to the healthcare system, brain injury, all that. I just happened to have a guy in my office Friday who happens to be related to a patient I had about 10 years ago, brain injury. And I said, how's Lucas doing? And he looked at me and he said, well, he kind of remembered me. And this kid is still having multiple surgeries, whatever, and this is just... This is a high-speed crash of a small sports car running into a motorhome, actually running under the motorhome. So things like that, and just what they said, doesn't matter how, even if you only raise the speed 5 miles, coming down the freeway now, it's 55 for trucks, 65 for cars. Let's talk about cars, 65. If I'm going 65, people are passing me going like that. They're going at least 80. And that all they're going to do is ramp that up another 10, 15, because people know they will get a ticket unless they're going about 15 miles over the speed limit.
So can I make one comment about brain injury, Mr. Chairman? We have about 5,000 closed head traumas a year in the state of Oregon. Half of them are motor vehicle crashes. And I had a lady in my office last week who needs a knee replacement. We were talking about scheduling that. And she started crying. She said, you know, I really can't do this because I'm still taking care of my son. Her son, 20 years ago, had a severe head injury in a motor vehicle crash, and she's caring for him at home. And that's the impact on that to the extended family is enormous. You take a young taxpayer who we've educated at public expense, and you make them into a disabled welfare recipient. And there are 5 or 10 of those for every death.
I just have one last point to make that may not have been made today. It may well be in this report. And that is the effect of high speeds on a highway when there is a crash scene and the highway doesn't happen to be shut down. and they're still making their way through. And some of these people, believe it or not, are still traveling 55 and 60 miles an hour, going this close to a gurney with a patient on it. And it is the most frightening thing that you can ever imagine. In our small volunteer district, we will park a fire truck perpendicular to the lane, allowing you only could go slowly around it, and people will slide into that truck. They just will not slow down. So I just, obviously, you know I'm a no vote on this. But thank you for indulging me.
Or comments. Thank you very much,
John
and Jill. Mark Cooperstein and Mike Lafferty. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman, and members of the House Transportation Committee, good afternoon. My name is Mark Cooperstein, and I am the chair of the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee, which is a five-member advisory panel appointed by the governor. Additionally, I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the Crime Prevention Association of Oregon and a member of the Portland Metropolitan Injury Prevention Council. And to pay my bills, I'm a deputy sheriff of the Clackamas County. Mm-hmm. Our goal for the Transportation Safety Committee is to lower the number of Oregonians killed and severely injured in transportation-related incidents, the bulk of which are on our highway system. Increasing the rural interstate speeds in Oregon on an across-the-board basis will kill and injure more Oregonians, and I encourage you to vote against this bill. We have had successes over the last couple of decades in saving Oregonians' lives through increased seatbelt use and continuing to crack down on drunk drivers. But we seem to get nowhere on the leading cause of crash fatalities, which is excessive speed. We don't raise the BAC, the blood alcohol content, because people are drinking more. We don't advocate lap belts only in cars or five warnings before a ticket is issued for no seatbelt use. But we seem to keep trying to raise the speed limits when speed is now the leading cause of preventable death in Oregon. There is no acceptable number of crash fatalities, especially considering that they are preventable and directly related to behavior. Over the last 3 years, we have killed just under 1,500 people on our highways with the current speeds, the laws, engineering, and enforcement levels that we have. That is like wiping out the towns of Amity, or Banks, or Brownsville, or Cannon Beach, or Canyonville, or Depot Bay, Heppner, Pilot Rock, or a dozen others. Last year, we as traffic safety professionals and Oregon legislators allowed 455 Oregonians to be killed, with 512 people killed in 2003. So far this year, 121 Oregonians have been killed on our highways, which is a 13% increase over this same time frame last year. We condoned the pain and suffering of over 30,000 Oregonians injured in crashes. Why? Because rather than focus every 2 years on ways to bring the number of Oregonians tragically killed or injured down, we seem to spend our efforts fighting attempts to allow more Oregonians to die through speed increase legislation. The current rural interstate speed law allows speeds up to 70 miles per hour on rural interstates, but requires that those sections requesting an increase be subjected to a thorough investigation by the state traffic engineer. Those reports, as we've mentioned, are available to you. These investigations take into consideration all the known factors that could result in more death and injury if speeds were increased on those sections of rural interstate, to include the construction of the highway, access to emergency medical treatment immediately following a high-speed crash, amount of enforcement and motorist assistance in those areas, and input from local citizens who live in the area and use the roads, and other factors, not just strictly plain engineering. When increasing the speeds on rural interstates, speeds and crashes on local roads and highways increase. Local livability issues, time spent by local police agencies to site investigate these crashes, the increase of use by local city resources can often be overlooked. For example, when there is a crash on a rural interstate and there are no OSP troopers to respond, does the crash hold until the next trooper can come? An hour? 4 hours? Tomorrow? No, the local city or county that the interstate passes through has to take the crash. The higher the speed involved, the longer they spend, since the damage and injuries will be much higher. Do they get reimbursed for the state for the time they spend out there instead of patrolling in the cities or counties that are paying for their services? No. Exceeding the posted speed limit is a choice made by drivers. It is what people decide to do, mostly based on their perception of safety or chances of being in a crash or getting a ticket. The average driver in Oregon does not know that the chances of dying or being seriously injured in a traffic crash double for every 10 miles per hour or 50 miles per hour they travel, which comes to about a 400% greater chance at 70 miles per hour than 50. They don't know that crash forces increase exponentially with speed increases, which can be 4 or 16 times more, increase the likelihood of death or injury. They don't know that the wonderful safety features in their vehicles are tested at 35 miles per hour and lose their effectiveness at higher speeds. But we do. Yet we sit here discussing whether or not to raise the speeds across the board when we know it will kill and injure more Oregonians. Please vote against this bill. The current one is just fine. And I'd like to introduce Mr. Mike Laverty.
Chairman Gilman and members of the committee, I'm Mike Laverty, and I'm a businessman in Depot Bay, and I don't want to wipe it out. Yet, anyway. I'm the owner of Fuddy Duddy Fudge. I'm also the board president for Alliance for Community Traffic Safety, known as ACTS Oregon, and have been since 1999. I also will be stepping down as president in September of this year, as I was appointed in February of this year by Governor Kulongoski to the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee. I'm here to testify against increasing speed limits on Oregon interstates. I feel we should support the decision of the Oregon Transportation Commission in not raising the interstate speed limits. Their decision was based on a report by the Oregon Speed Panel Review Panel's recommendation. The panel's decision was based on testimony received from individuals throughout the state. After hearing and reading testimony received, the panel was against recommending increasing interstate speed. One of the important items that came out of the study is, we firmly believe that the most effective means for bringing drivers into compliance with Oregon speed laws requires the following actions. Provide more resources to the Oregon State Police for speed enforcement. Reduce the current 10 to 15 mile an hour tolerance for speeding. Improve our driver's education program. Develop an effective public education program regarding the hazards associated with excessive speed on our highways. Speeding is glamorized in our culture as part of the American way of life. But the reality is speed kills, and it's a serious problem in Oregon. Each year, speeding drivers kill more innocent Oregonians than drinking drivers. For every Oregon resident, speed-related crashes cost $195. It's the basic law of physics. The higher the speed, the greater the impact. That means risk or death or injury. For speeds greater than 50 miles an hour, 1 mile equals 10 deaths or injuries. The carryover effect describes how drivers are velocipedized when coming off freeways, meaning they're desensitized to how fast they're traveling on more dangerous secondary roads. The results are that death increases on secondary roads.
Mike?
Yes, sir.
We appreciate this testimony, and we have it. We can read it. Could you just summarize, please? I think there's 5 pages of it. Is that
I'm not reading you 5 pages, sir.
Oh,
I have
not
summarized it.
Okay.
And if you would like, it's just another page.
Okay.
Is all I have left.
Okay.
Drivers are not the only ones affected by excessive speed. Speeding drivers also put their passengers at risk. While most drivers accept the idea that speed kills, they also have found ways to justify their own speeding habits because they think they will never get in a crash. One common myth is, I'm in control at higher speeds. The reality is, speeding affects every driver's reaction and stopping times, both of which increase the likelihood and severity of crashes. 90% of Oregon's fatal crashes are caused by drivers' deliberate choice of behavior. Most significant are excessive speeds, drinking and driving, not using seat belts. Some of the other behaviors are driving distracted, driving drowsy, or using cell phones. These deaths are especially tragic because drivers simply changing their behavior could prevent them. Some speed-related facts, stats are, from 1999 to 2002, speeding drivers were responsible for 833 deaths, including innocent victims and themselves. From 1999 to 2002, speeding drivers killed 323 innocent victims, bicyclists, pedestrians, drivers of other vehicles, friends, relatives, children of their own, and other vehicles. From 1999 to 2002, speeding drivers killed themselves 61% of the time. From 1999 to 2002, speeding drivers took the lives of innocent people 39% of the time. What an absolute tragedy, 323 innocent lives lost just because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Reducing excessive speed in Oregon will reduce crashes, prevent injuries, and save taxpayers money and countless innocent lives. As a traffic safety advocate, I'm concerned about the 60 to 70 injuries for every death on our road, the so-called golden hour for stabilizing in hospital trauma care, which reduces death rates by half. Is critical, yet Baker County residents may experience EMS response times of over 45 minutes. And the nearest level 2 trauma hospitals are in Bend, Boise, or Walla Walla. I urge you, sir, to not raise the speed limit on the interstate highways.
Thank you, Mike. Questions? Same thing.
Yes, I do have questions. I'm not sure if it's for you or for the engineers that were up here earlier, but I think there have been studies about speed differentials talking about how if you have traffic traveling at, say, 50 miles an hour, yet you have somebody going 40 miles an hour, that really sets up for a disaster. I'm just wondering if any of that has played into the statistics here, talking about speed differentials.
I can say that differentials do cause concern. If you have a semi that's going 50 or 60 miles an hour and a driver who's given permission to go 70, who's now going 80 to 85 on a rural interstate coming up behind that semi, it's going to cause him some quick decision making as he comes up behind that, change lanes quickly or hit it. Differential is a concern. Statistically, I would have to defer to some of the ODOT folks with our Transportation Safety Division unless Mike has those.
No, I don't.
So,
I'm sorry.
I just want one more last question. It seems like I read a lot, and just this is a devil's advocate question. Raising the speeds kills more people. Has there been some advocacy to lower the speeds to, say, down to 40 where the cars are tested? And I'm just wondering, if not, which I don't think there has, then why not?
I think one of the biggest frustrations I've had in the 33 years as a police officer and the last eight or 10 years now I've been doing traffic safety advocacy is we seem to be putting out so many fires that we never have a chance to address the issue. We never seem to get people saying, all right, we've stabilized, let's start lowering these numbers now. It's always trying to bring things, keep things where they're at rather than lower. There are some sections of our rural interstates down in southern Oregon, for example, where it is totally unsafe to go even the posted speed in most of the other parts of the state, 65 miles an hour. Around the Medford area, there's places where it's 50 to 55 at the most, and if you go over that, you're going to tip over. So we don't, trying to paint the issue across the whole state doesn't seem to work. You have to take each segment of roadway and take all these factors together, and there may be places that we're currently going 65 that maybe we shouldn't be. But we just haven't had time to do that.
Further questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Elliot. From AAA. Elliot. How do you pronounce your last name? You'll have to help me with this.
Thank you.
Okay. One.
Putting me up here all by myself, huh? Good afternoon. My name is Elliot Ecke. I'm Public Affairs Director for AAA Oregon.
which represents 550,000 Oregonians. I'm here today to simply encourage you to reject the bill as it is written for several safety-related issues. We do not oppose the 70-mile-per-hour speed limit per se. What we are concerned with are the travel or speed differentials. According to a NHTSA study, the average speed, average motorist travels about 8 miles an hour faster than the posted speed limit. At 70 miles an hour, that would put our traffic out there on I-5 and 84 at about 80 miles an hour. And I think that figure probably is outdated. As I drove down from Portland today, I will admit I was doing 70 miles an hour, but I think I was one of the slowest cars on the freeway. And those speed differentials really do have us concerned. The difference between those speeders and the people obeying the law could be too great and create some very serious consequences. Proponents of the 70-mile-an-hour speed limit will tell you that the freeways were built for 75. Will tell you that the freeways were built for 75 miles an hour, and they'll tell you that the cars today are much more superior to what we had back in the 50s and 60s. The one thing I would like to point out that they failed to recognize is that back in the 60s there were only 919,000 cars registered in Oregon. In 1995, there were almost 3 million cars registered in the state of Oregon. And I think, if I'm correct, the number today puts it closer to about 4 million registered in the state of Oregon. Those of you who are familiar with the Portland metro area, I think you'll agree that all of them are on the highways between 7 a.m., between Salem and Portland and Vancouver and Troutdale and Gresham. The kinds of speeds that we're seeing with this kind of congestion just begs for a greater fatality rate, and we need to find a way to control that. Our thought is that until we can control the speeders, the law should not be changed. Speeding is a huge problem. Another issue that we have is that one way to control the speed would be to add troopers. And as Dr. Tung mentioned, that may not be the ultimate answer, but still, we do need to have some sort of unified enforcement program out there that people know if they're going to break the law, they have a chance of getting busted. If you travel down I-5, as I mentioned, you'll find it, people going anywhere from 65 to about 90 on a regular basis. They're not just in the fast lane. They're in the middle lane, they're in the right-hand lane, and if you happen to be in front of them, they get pretty perturbed, and then you see the potential for some very, very serious road rage incidents occurring. Finally, our opposition to the bill as it's written is that our interpretation is that it precludes any intervention by the State Department of Transportation to analyze these stretches of highways where there may be a high rate of accidents and to change or modify the speed limits. The state needs to have that ability. We can't let bodies just keep piling up on some of these places and say, well, sorry, we are not going to allow the state to make any changes. It's our responsibility, I think, it's the state's responsibility to make sure that we keep the conditions as safe as possible. Therefore, you know, AAA Oregon is saying, please leave the speed limits the way they are.
Thanks, Elliot. Thank you. Question.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Patrick.
Thank you. Just one. Talking about the speed differentials again, if you've got people currently going 80, 90 miles an hour and raising the speed limit to 70, wouldn't that close that speed differential a bit?
Let me give you the worst case scenario for speed differential. You're going up, you're going down I-5, I should say, and you're approaching Grants Pass, and you're hitting one of those mountain passes. You're going 70 miles an hour, and all of a sudden you realize that the truck in front of you is doing 5, just because they can't pull the load much faster than that. The guy next to you is doing 75, and so you can't get into that left-hand lane as an escape route. You will also find people who don't want to go 70 miles an hour. If you hit the freeways, you'll find there are a lot of people who feel unsafe doing more than 60. And so they will try to take the left-hand lane or the right-hand lane, although a great number of them do stay in the center lane, and they do cause a lot of problems. This morning on my way to work, I saw a car coming around the corner, and the roads were slick, but I was pretty impressed that this woman was able to keep the car under control. But she hit her binders way early, and she barely missed hitting that car. And this is at a time when you see traffic moving very slowly, even when you're going through the Terwilliger curves at 8:30 in the morning, and the speed limit's supposed to be 50 miles an hour. You're seeing cars going through there at 65 and 70. During the rush hour, it's at a crawl, and you see people still trying to go at that rate. So, you know, I think this whole issue of speed just needs to be downplayed a little bit. I'm as great a NASCAR fan as anybody else. I lived in North Carolina, where if you weren't one, you didn't belong in the state. But I've got to tell you, people have to come to their senses and realize that even though the cars today are safer, they don't make you invincible.
Thank you, Elliot.
Thank you.
Oh, excuse me. One more.
Well, just a comment. Oh. When you drive overseas, and mostly in Europe, Northern Europe, they have an unspoken rule that you don't use the left lane or the middle lane unless you're passing. You use the right lane. And if it's trucks only, and they're serious, you can get a ticket. But if you are in the left lane going the speed limit and someone comes up behind you and you don't pull over and there's an officer there, you get a ticket for that too. So they do kind of have their own way of doing it, and they are going faster than 70, that's for sure.
Okay. Next, Lieutenant Gary Miller.
Good afternoon. Chair Burley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary G. Miller. I'm currently the Assistant Director of the Patrol Services Division for the Oregon State Police. I'm also a nationally accredited crash reconstructionist and have been since 1984. The Oregon State Police has strong concerns with House Bill 3252. Any increase in speed will result in an increase in crashes. More crashes mean more injuries and more deaths. Not including the emotional toll these crashes will take, they also will result in more road closure time, greater economic costs to businesses, increased motorist frustration, and a greater burden on the medical field. All the time when the department has no 24-hour offices and has few resources to ensure that speeds will not go up any further than they already have. Just a 5-mile-an-hour increase in speed will result in a 16% increase in energy capabilities. In other words, that would be an increase to cause actual damage or injuries, and about a 13% increase in stopping abilities for most vehicles. I have attached some supporting documentation on the following pages. You'll see them. They have some information. One of them just is a difference between 65 and 70 with some statistical data, and the other one is traffic safety facts. Last session, the legislature passed the speed limit bill that gave the Oregon Department of Transportation the authority to study affected highways and to come to an independent and well-defined analysis to determine reasonableness and safety. That process resulted in a decision not to increase speeds for most vehicles in most areas. However, there were a couple of areas that, after much study and analysis, were raised 5 miles an hour for passenger vehicles. Just for your information, I was one of the 5 members on the Speed Zone Review Panel. The Department of State Police, we encourage and support that continued process that the Department of Transportation took in the last session. Thank you for allowing me to testify before you today, and I'll be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions? Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I try, you know, having listened to this conversation before, I'm trying to remember on the speed study that we had done in the interim that led up to this, and how much weight did the truck versus car differential play in the decision not to increase the speeds to 70 miles per hour?
Chair Burley, Representative Byer. The Speed Zone Review Panel had quite a lot of discussion on that, and there were 3 engineers and Dr. Tung and myself. And in that vote and some of the votes on the trucks, it was discussed quite a bit with the energy amounts that trucks possess at 80,000 pounds, and I think I've testified before that a car roughly needs to do around 240 miles an hour to have the same energy capabilities as a truck doing 55. So there was some discussion on that. The speed differential that's been brought up was discussed, and the committee heard absolutely no clear evidence for one side or the other on that argument. In fact, it was there was no definitive evidence to support either side of that argument. And so when it came down to it, I believe, I may be a little bit off on that, but I think there were maybe, it was a discussion centered on trucks, but also centered on cars, and just the increases in general for both types of vehicles would be unsafe.
Yeah, thank you. I'll maybe ask someone else too. But I guess I'll just make a quick statement, because it was somewhat of my understanding that we had tied, you know, that you couldn't increase the car passenger vehicles without an increase in the truck traffic. And it was my understanding that that had a big weigh factor in not increasing the passenger vehicle, because they didn't think it was safe to increase the truck speed. So,
Representative Burley, or Chair Burley, Representative Byler, that is correct. And in the part that I think it had to be within 5 miles an hour of the passenger vehicle, and there was a lot of discussion on that, and there was a lot of concern by several people, and that was most likely a factor in some people's. I know it was a strong factor in my decision. However, it was not the only factor in my decision.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I've got one, kind of Miller. Having been on the speed zone review panel, the studies that ODOT did, I mean, some of the current speed monitoring, the speed monitoring data that they did shows on a lot of these what I guess would be considered rural interstate by this definition, that the 85 percentile, which appears to be kind of some yardstick that's used here, I mean, 74.6, 73.4, 74.6, 77.5, 77.3, etc. And so people are driving these speeds already on these rural interstates, but and also given the fact the earlier comment I read reading out of the engineer's report were from that particular individual's engineering perspective, these rural interstates are capable of 70 miles an hour. But I guess, And I also want to echo what Representative Byers said earlier. It was also my understanding that the differential between the passenger car and the trucks was a bit of a sticking point. And if I'm not mistaken, the 7060 that's in this proposed bill addresses that very issue. But the question I have for you, Lieutenant, is having been on the committee and hearing all the evidence and looking at all the data and all the information, and then you look at the recommendations in this report, and many of these recommend to increase the speed limit by 5 miles an hour on interstate here on I-5 and some other places. And I guess, I mean, all these arguments that we're hearing about the velocity and the impact and all these types of things apply 65 to 70 just as well as they do from 55 to 60 or 60 to 65. So how can we rationalize that it's okay in some areas but it's not on others?
Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, I think the best way I can answer that is any increase in speed is going to cause some type of problem someplace down the road. I mean, we all are aware of that. And then you weigh reasonableness with safety on transiting our highways in the state. And, again, there's many factors in these speeds. That 85th percentile, and I should leave this for Oregon Department of Transportation and Ed Fisher, who the engineers are much better at this than I am. But that was just one of many, many factors. In eastern Oregon, where you're talking about some of these areas, they were looking at medical facilities, how long it would take them to get there, and some other things. They were looking at number of law enforcement personnel and those type of issues. In one office in eastern Oregon, they were looking at, there's two troopers. And so there were a number of issues that looked at, and yes, you're correct, and you know, any increase is going to, you know, there's going to be a pro and con to any of these type of things. And I think that's about the best way I can answer that.
If the speed limit on rural interstates were to be raised to 70 and somebody by their own choosing continued to drive 65 because they were afraid they weren't close enough to a trauma center, would they get a ticket for doing that?
Not if they were driving in the right lane in a correct manner, they would not.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Troy, I guess you're going to clean up that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I've been taking some notes in the back to try and address some of the questions that you may have brought forward, as well as address the items that are in Bodut's testimony. Been a lot of questions and remarks in relationship to what ODOT did for the response to the bill that was passed last session for study and review of the interstate system in Oregon. Here is the study. This is all the work that went into the review, including the engineering report, the site-specific study report, and the issues report, and all of the deliberations and public testimony that went into that review. The department and the commission, and through the speed zone review panel, did a tremendous amount of work around the state, as was presented to you earlier, and taking testimony both written as well as on site. Went to various places along the I-84 and I-5 corridor to hold the hearing. So wasn't everybody having to come to Salem. They went into the field twice to hear comments. And the diligence put towards the study and the results coming from that and the recommendation from the commission were well thought out, very public, and a lot of opportunity for people to make comment, and was the right decision in the end. One thing I'd like to point out about interstate speed, we happen to have about a 50-mile stretch of road that's bisected by the Oregon-Idaho state line. On the Oregon side, it's 65 miles an hour for passenger cars and 55 for trucks, and on the Idaho side, it is much higher. What's interesting to look at is that over a couple-year history, just the same topography, this is before Boise, it's very rural, same type of environment, yet when you look at that, on the Idaho side, there have been over 200 crashes and 3 fatalities and 80 injuries. But on the Oregon side, there's only 65 crashes compared to their 200, 1 fatality compared to 3, and 22 injuries compared to 80. And the only difference, it's the same vehicles, the same travel pattern, the same volume, same splits between trucks and cars, is what's posted on the sign. And the driver behavior that is exhibited, because that sign on the auto side says you can go faster. What happens is, as you heard, the energy and all those types of things involved is resulting in more fatalities and more injuries. The other thing that over the past few sessions have been talked about in relationship to a change in Oregon law, the only thing we have to do is to go back into our history when we did have 70 posted on the interstate, or to look at other states that have changed. On page 2 of my testimony, I picked a couple states that a lot of people like to compare against, Idaho or Colorado, and Colorado because of similar number of miles and similar geography in relationship to the types of highways and the mountain passes and things. In Oregon, when we were under a 70 or in a couple of small segments, a 75-mile-an-hour maximum speed limit, every year we had 50 fatalities. And that was without 205, and a few other areas. So the number of miles of rural interstate has actually increased since this time. We also had 1,274 crashes every year, over 100 crashes a month on the rural interstate segment. For the past 14 years, when we've been under a 65-mile-an-hour limit, that number of fatalities has dropped to 37, and the number of crashes to 1,069. So when you look back at our history, fewer cars, fewer road miles, the fatalities were much greater than they are now under 65. And you compare it to Idaho, you compare it to Colorado, and I gave you two examples of what happened in Colorado. Very recent, when they were 65 and when they posted 75, they saw, you know, a 25% plus jump in the number of fatalities as well as crashes on their rural interstate system when they went and posted the higher limit. Some items with the bill specifically, if I may, under the area of my testimony called issues. I have attached to the testimony the last page is, as we referenced earlier, where we have done a public opinion poll, because this has been something the legislature has debated a lot, so gauging the public around the state. What has been the percentage of opposition with or support of raising the interstate speed? And you'll see over that time it has all been above 50%, some cases above 60% against, and that's for all areas of the state, not just the Portland metropolitan area. It's geographically split on the survey. The other item in relationship specific to the bill is that it was just mentioned, and that is the bill eliminates ODOT's ability to post a lower speed because of the geography of the road or because if there's increase in fatal or injuries around the state. So there are current four segments on the interstate that are going to change by this bill. Cabbage Hill will change. Myrtle Creek Curves will change. The Smith Hill Summit will change. And the Siskiyou Summit will change. But what is posted now for a lower limit because of the needs of the geography and the road will now be posted under this bill at 70-60. For our out-of-state drivers, that's basically a signal of how fast they can go through those areas without the regard for what the road design or what the traveling speed must be. This does not impact Twigger Curves because that's inside the urban area. So these are segments that are in the rural area only. And I'm concerned about the liability we take on if we've got a 70-60 posted in one of those spots and people going through in whatever weather, and we've given them some sort of indication it's a clear signal to go that fast, and that road, we already know we had it posted at one point in time under a study to be lower than that. This bill eliminates ODOT's ability to use its discretion in those areas. The other part is also was mentioned about what happens if there is increase in fatalities, injuries in a particular spot. This bill eliminates ODOT's ability to also make a change. And some questions were brought up about the rural interstate. Some of the things to consider when looking at what all went into this study is what's in between the opposing lanes of travel as far as a median is concerned. What is on the roadside? You think about your commute. If you've been on interstate recently, think back for a little segment. You will see very few guardrails on your right-hand side. There's usually a clear zone. And you think about I-84, there's a lot of segments where there's rocks. And there's no barrier in between. The higher the speed, the quicker you're going to be into that area, the less likely and the less time you're going to have to react to get back out. Talked about Europe. In Europe, they do have some roads that are higher speed and some that are unlimited speed. But in every single one of those roads, there is guardrail in the center and on the right. And the trucks must be in the right-hand lane, or they will get a ticket. And they are limited to 80 kilometers per hour, which is 50 miles an hour, and they're not allowed to pass. They must stay on the right-hand side. The other thing in Europe is they use speed cameras in their over bridges, the speed limit bridges and their sign bridges. They have cameras. You will get a speeding ticket if you go underneath that, above what the posted speed limit is. And in Europe, if you get your second speeding ticket inside of 5 years, you lose your license. So there's a lot of other things that go with this than just saying compare ourselves to Europe. Comment was on differentials. There's a different kind of differential involved here besides cars and trucks. It has been shown the higher the speed limit or the posted sign you have on a road, the broader and the speed differential is going to be for those that are traveling. There will be people that will go slower, but there are going to be a bunch of people that are going to ratchet up as well. So you're going to end up broadening the traveling speed of those cars through those segments if there's a higher number posted. That's been proven all over the world. The higher the number, the bigger the zone of difference between what cars and vehicles are traveling. And then the last item I wanted to point out for you, I did attach for you a map. And what this is showing you is just the fatalities and serious injuries. These are people that had to stay overnight in a hospital or longer, you know, more than one night or longer, on the interstate system for a 3-year time period. In some of these cases, had this been a local highway in your district, you've been calling my office wanting to put up safety corridor signs and to do something with the speed, because this is just the speed-related. This is not the total. These are the speed-related fatal and serious injuries on the interstate system as we have it posted today in the state of Oregon. We're very fortunate in our state to have a very well-maintained, marked, signed interstate system, and it is a safe interstate system. And given all of the matters that have been brought to you today in relationship to enforcement and availability of emergency medical services, at this point in time, it's a question as to whether or not this is the right time to raise the speed limit. From a public policy point of view, raising that level of risk, but we're not necessarily doing anything on the other side to mitigate what that risk is going to do to not only our citizens of the state, but to our guests that come in all across the state borders. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any other questions. I tried to hit all of them that various members had asked of the prior presenters.
Thanks, Troy. Questions? No. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Troy, I'll ask you the same question I asked the earlier Lieutenant Miller. In the Oregon Speed Zone Review Panel recommendations, they do recommend raising the speed limits on certain parts of the interstate system by 5 miles an hour, some 55 to 60, and I think some of them, I thought I saw 60 to 65, but anyways, they're still raising them, recommended them 5 miles per hour. So if we can do this, for example, on I-84 in East Portland metro area, where we have a great deal of rush hour and congestion and all that, and yet when I hop on I-84 out at Biggs or somewhere out there and take off for Pendleton or LeGrand or Baker, and there's a fraction of the vehicles on the road, why can't we do it out there? The inconsistency overwhelms me.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Burley, see if I can address this in a couple different points, because as was mentioned, this was not just looking at travel speed. There were a lot of other things that were involved. Those segments that you refer to of going from a 55-55 combination to a 60 for passenger vehicles and 55 for trucks was a lot of debate within the Speed Zone Review Panel and was a lot of debate with the Commission. It was not something that they just checked the box and said, off we go. Some of the things that were under consideration was the current travel speed. Also, the last time that those areas were studied, what was that road alignment? What were the lane widths? What was in relationship to the shoulders or the medians? Because in every one of those areas that you're referring to, there have been construction changes than what they used to be. Looked at the traffic volume. Looked at the split between cars and trucks, what the relative percentage is. Looked at the availability of law enforcement, and in this case, not just the Oregon State Police, but also, as you heard mentioned, a lot of times city and county are now enforcing some portions of the state highway or, in some cases, reacting to crashes that are there. Looked at the availability of medical services as far as what would be available in that area if something was to occur, and put all that together. And when that recommendation came forward to the commission was not unanimous in accepting that. It was a split vote by the commission as well. So it's in its totality, all those different elements that were put together to go into that decision of saying those segments, and actually eliminated. There was a fourth segment that was talked about going to 60, and they took that off. So not all the segments recommended were even abided by what the commission went forward with. I hope I answered your question.
Well, given the factors that you current speed, road design, traffic patterns, availability of law enforcement, availability of ALS, or however you want to characterize that, is there, and I unfortunately haven't had a chance to go through all of this quite that thoroughly yet, but can you provide me with the reports by whomever addressing those specific criteria for these rural interstate sections of highway? Because, you know, I drive I-84 in East Portland, and I also drive it clear out to the Idaho border, and I mean, I'm not the traffic engineer, but I don't see a great deal of difference with road design and some of the, like I said, I mean, the design to me seems just as well, if not better. The traffic patterns are far fewer vehicles. The current speed is already high per the data that ODOT collected with the speed monitoring data, where I pointed out 85 percentile, which we'll get to here in a moment. But so I'd like to see if we have this information, exactly why it is that these rural interstate highways, and I, you know, I could agree with some of the things down around Medford and the Siskiyous, but especially out in eastern Oregon, where I'm more familiar with, I don't see how these criteria, except for perhaps the ALS access, would keep us from raising the limit. So if you have that, I'd like to
see. Mr. Chair and Representative Burley, I'd be happy to get that for you.
Okay.
It may be as big as this, but
that's great. I have nothing else to do, so I'm happy to read this stuff. The other question I have for you in your testimony on, which I seem to have displaced you, on the second page, you bring out the fatality rates. The Oregon rural interstates from 61 to 73, which at that time was 70-75 miles an hour, 3.78 fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. And then 87 to 2001, when it was 65, it's down to 0.99. I think it's interesting also to note that in the period of 1974 to 1986, when we were doing 55 miles per hour, the fatality rate was 1.35. So it was actually higher when we were doing 55 than it has been for the past however many years doing 65. What could we attribute that to?
But, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Burley, it is a factor of the amount of miles that individuals are driving. I mean, that is the other half of the equation. Where my office tries to focus on is the actual death count, the actual injury count, instead of going at it based on rate. Because if we had, over the past decade or so, instead of 450 or 470 fatalities in the state, statewide, if we had said we're going to do everything on rate, every year 3% more vehicle miles are traveled in the state, that means, fine, we'll have 3% more deaths and 3% more injuries. So our focus is on the numbers. And actually, referring back to Europe, that is where they're going as well. A lot of countries started to do this, well, rated on vehicle miles traveled or based on population or based on the number of vehicles. Everybody's starting to recognize to say, wait a minute, in the United States, we're killing 42,000 people. We talk about a death rate of 1.5. Well, that seems nothing. When you say 42,000 people each year in this nation are killed in traffic crashes, that's the number that we've got to drop down. Because if we do nothing and just allow 3% vehicle miles traveled to go up every year, that means we're accepting 3% more death and injury every year.
Well, at the risk of sounding callous, and I can appreciate that, but many other businesses, particularly the insurance business, does work on averages. And if you look at the actual number of fatalities in those same three time periods, you've got at 70 miles an hour we had 50, at 55 miles an hour we had 32, at 65 we had 37. That's actual fatalities. And I would be curious whether or not there's any statistically any significance in those numbers.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Burley, we could look at that, but as you noted, when we went from 55 to 65, the death count per year went up by 7 on average per year.
But could we not attribute some of that declining trend? Yeah, we have more miles being traveled, but don't we also have improved highway safety measures, better road design, better vehicular design, mandatory seatbelt laws? We've got many things in place to improve the safety features.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, you're correct on all those counts, that all those things add up. Yet the bottom line factor in all that is that, as was mentioned, cars are tested at 35. Your headlights are only going to show you what's out in front of you at 50 or 55 miles an hour. So if you're going faster than that at night, you're out driving your headlight, even with the new high-intensity discharge headlights that are there. Vehicles are built better differently. Tires are built better differently. But you and I aren't. You and I as human beings are not any different than what was before, and the laws of physics haven't changed. And as was mentioned, the second and third collisions, you hit something, the faster you go, the seatbelt may help your physical body, the airbag may help your physical body, but your brain and your internal organs and everything else are still going to be going 65, 70, 75 miles an hour. That's not changed. You don't have an internal airbag, unfortunately, to keep your brain from hitting your forehead. And you know, all those things add up. The more speed there is, the higher the energy that's going to be released. And the question, you know, before you is, where is that level of acceptable public risk? It's been shown that death injuries go up. I cannot show you any other state that's raised their numbers and have not seen an increase in death and injury. Even with all the higher enforcement, the better cars, their better roads, their better enforcement, their numbers go up too.
One more?
Oh, sure. Not lots. In 2001, since we're on actual number of fatalities, and this was an email from somebody, Troy. 2001, all interstate highways in Oregon, 35 fatalities. All other state highways in 2001, 253 fatalities. All county roads in 2001, 135 fatalities. And all city streets in 2001, 64 fatalities. So it seems to me like we're doing pretty good on the interstates.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, that's correct.
Okay, so if we bump it up 5 miles an hour, all things considered, I mean, where should we really be putting our focus on this?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, as was mentioned earlier, we saw in the state of Washington when they raised their interstate speed limits, the carryover speed to those other roads, predominantly state highways or county roads that are posted currently in the state at 55 miles an hour, will see an increase in travel speed as well. And you will say there is a complete 180-degree difference between the way the interstate is designed and the way those connecting roadways are designed. And you also, in a lot of those cases, have volunteer law enforcement, you have volunteer paramedics and such that are trying to respond to those. And so it's not just going to end the predicted 10 to 15% increase in interstates. It's also going to have a predicted increase on all those other roads as well. But in the analysis of coming forward, you're just, in fact, impacting the interstates. That's the only numbers I'm going to tell you what the direct impact is. But I do know it's going to impact the other roads as well because they're not designed like the interstate. The stopping distance, the on-ramps, the off-ramps, the bottom of the hill where the stop sign is, you're carrying all that speed into those areas, and there's going to be more of an issue. And that was part of what some of the public around the state, when they came to the speed limit review panel hearings, that's part of what they were bringing up, is they don't want to be at the bottom of their exit stop sign, knowing that people behind them are now going even faster and having to figure out how to get out of the way because they can't stop. The other concern I have, too, Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, is the fact that we've got some work zones coming across the state. And you're talking about an area where the roadbed itself is going to be different than what you and I may expect on any day. And you've got people that are out there working in those areas that are going to become vulnerable to the potential higher speed being carried through work zones. We already struggle with getting people to slow down through our work zones as it is. Higher posted speed limits is going to give people that much more energy going into those work zones and harder to slow them down as they go through there, where we've got people out there that are very vulnerable.
Absolutely agree with that. One more time, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Troy, would you please explain more exactly what this 85 percentile figure is, where it came from, what it's intended to do?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I'm not an engineer, but have been in and around the conversation quite a bit, so I'll try and put it in the terms that I have been asked, have been able to explain. 85th percentile means that is 85% of the traffic on that road is going that speed or lower. So does that mean that 85% of the traffic is going 77 or 72? It means they're going that speed or lower. And it is a engineering benchmark, or as you had mentioned another phrase, just kind of a guide to say if 85th percentile from engineering point of view, the people are driving what they believe is safe and reasonable for the area that is around them. That 85th percentile was created multiple decades ago, not with today's cars that you basically don't really have to touch the steering wheel to go straight for a mile or two. It was when you actually had to drive your car and you could feel the corner and you could feel the different bumps on the road because of your tires and your steering and stuff. So there is question within some of the engineering community as to whether the 85th percentile is something that should be used today because the roads and the cars are so much different than decades ago when the 85th percentile was created. But bottom line to your answer is 85th percentile, that speed or slower.
So am I correct then, I mean, if this was spring quarter 2002 speed monitoring data, it's not really that clear to me, but I'm presuming this must be I-5. It says Wilsonville, 85 percentile was 74.6. So that means 85% of the vehicles were traveling that or less.
Mr. Chair, that is correct for those weather conditions at that point in time. When you do engineering studies and look at speed analysis, you deal with time of day, day of week, and what time of the year, and so you can try and get a measure for the whole 365 days, 24/7, to understand. Taking one small moment in time doesn't always mean that that's the way it is for the rest of the year.
Last one, I promise.
You can keep going.
So
we've got a half hour yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
In the next call. Okay. March 24, 2003, Doug Tindall, engineer from ODOT, testified at the House Transportation Committee, and I quote, "If we set the speed correctly, the speed the people are actually traveling should remain about the same because of the way we do the speed zone study. We should be setting the speed at a speed that people are comfortable traveling." Now, doesn't that go along more or less with this 85 percentile? If people are traveling that speed, that must be something that they feel comfortable traveling?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, the statement is accurate from the engineering point of view. It doesn't take into account all those other factors that were brought in to say, you know, what are the impacts of what's there. However, in some cases, there have been examples of where that statement's been proven untrue when they've posted a number and you've seen a 2 to 4 to 6 mile an hour creep in the 85th percentile about 2 years out from when you set it.
Okay, I just also want to point out, Mr. Chair, just for the record, that I appreciate Troy's bringing to our attention the fact that as drafted, this bill does not give ODOT the flexibility for areas like an assist use, and that's a very good point. Thank you. Thank you, Troy.
More questions? Representative Booth.
Actually, this is for Representative Burley. When we were in Baker City with the Health Committee a couple weekends ago, one of the bills that came up had to do with some EMS workers, and apparently in the one, I can't think of the name of the town, but Monument, Kimberly, somewhere around there, there's 7 volunteers on the force. And when the guy takes, when he has to go grocery shopping, he has to take the ambulance out of service. So when you drive over there, you might want to call him and make sure he's done his shopping for the week.
All right.
Well, anything if I may respond, Monument's not on the rural
area. Yeah, I don't think this
is yeah. There you go. Okay. Point taken.
Okay. We have one more person to testify, and maybe more than that, on this bill. And then I want to announce that 2840 has suffered a meltdown out in the hallway, and we will not be moving that bill today. There'll be another set of amendments, and I think it's going to be a multiple choice. This committee will make up our mind which one we're going to do.
You grade on a curve.
Carl Thatcher.
Thank you, Representative Gilman, for hearing my testimony. I was in the building trying to influence my representative by dropping off flowers, but she wasn't around, so I happened to catch some of the testimony that was going on, and I just couldn't resist coming down to just say something. The empirical evidence is true that if you raise your speed limit or your speed differential, that you are going to have more crashes, more injuries, and more deaths. That's not really the point of government. The point of government is we can smoke, we can drink, there's going to be more deaths. You folks represent the people. The people speed. They speed in excess of the speed limit. And we're either going to make them criminals, or we are going to bring some more reasonability to the process. Boy, I'm nervous. I didn't know I'd be nervous. Anyway, Doug Tindall is right. People should drive the speed they're comfortable driving. And currently, the car I drove at 16 would not want to drive at 70 miles an hour. But the car I currently drive is capable of that speed and has improved safety features. So I welcome any questions as just a member of Joe Q Public from District 25.
Thank you, Carl.
Questions?
Representative Burley.
What kind of flowers were they?
They were the flower bouquet that you get at Costco at a reasonable price.
I must How far ahead did you have to call to make the appointment?
Generally, you need to catch her a week in advance to get an appointment.
Even a
representative by her, and then I'm going to have to play the speaker's role. These young thoughts are made.
Well, Mr. Chair, mine will be. I am at least surprised. I am happy to see at least one voice in support of the bill, besides Representative Burley, maybe, but I was waiting to see whether or not there was going to be anybody in favor of the bill, so thank you.
Representative Byer, Representative Gilman, you're welcome.
Yeah, and I appreciate it because you also look at this, and it's mostly professionals in the field one way or another, and we do represent all Oregonians, and it's critical that we have people come in.
One final question. This is very important, too, because I'm an old car buff. So what kind of car did you have when you were 16?
I had a Pinto.
Good thing you didn't.
Thank you, Carl.
Thank you.
Anyone else to testify on
3252?
I close the public hearing on 3252, and I don't have anything else. Anything else from members? And Patrick, nothing?
Well, Chair, I believe we have it out for Wednesday. Okay. I'll try to get the members materials for that tomorrow.
Those of you that are interested in school zones, we will try to have those amendments ready soon. So it might be next Monday before we move it out, but we're going to get it out